This is David Harlow at Health Blog, and today I am speaking with Timothy Wademan at the Urban Institute and with Kyle Caswell as well. Tim is a senior fellow in the Health Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where Kyle is a research associate. They are co-authors of a report on Medicaid released yesterday, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, as part of the Affordable Care Act Implementation Monitoring and Tracking Initiative. The report is titled Financial Burden of Medical Spending by State and the Implications of the 2014 Medicaid Expansions. Welcome, Tim and Kyle, and thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So the title of the report you've just released is a bit dense. I wonder if you could unpack it a bit for us before diving in.
So let me look at the title again.
The Financial Burden of Medical Spending by State and the Implications of the 2014 Medicaid Expansion.
Right. So the basic idea of this report is that we study how much income the non-elderly population devotes to medical spending, and we look at that state by state. And the idea is, by looking at this variation and then focusing in on the low-income population in particular, we hope to learn what states' decisions about whether or not to expand their Medicaid programs as part of the Affordable Care Act, what implication those decisions might have for their own population. So this is, if a state has a particularly high level of burden of medical care spending, it's likely that expanding Medicaid will have a larger beneficial impact than a state that has a relatively low level of financial burden. So that's kind of the what we were trying to tease out of the data was a comparison along those lines.
Okay. Are there other takeaways from the report?
Well, so the first cut of this was just to look. I mean, this is a relatively new data source with which we can do this kind of study. The current population study is a nationwide large survey that has samples in every state, and it allows us to look down at even small states and say to get some idea of population characteristics. And a couple of years ago, they added to the survey a question or a couple of questions on how much people spend out of pocket on premiums and other expenditures for their health care, so whether co-pays or co-insurance payments, deductibles, those kinds of things. And so the first cut at this was just to look over the whole population, and we focus on non-elderly because Medicare is a sort of different world for medical spending. But excluding that population, we're able to see quite a bit of variation from state to state in how burdensome medical care is to the typical family, to typical person. So, for example, a typical person in New York, say, in the state of New York, spends about 2% of their total family income on medical care. But in Idaho, the typical person spends more than twice as much as a share of their income, and they spend about 5% of their income on health care. So that's just the typical person in the middle of the distribution.
So that's in the general non-elderly population.
Yeah.
And is the spread, is the differential as pronounced for the Medicaid population?
So in fact, it's even greater for the low-income population, which we focus in on later. But so even then, when you look, if staying with the general population, if you look at if you say, well, the typical person doesn't really use a lot of medical care. What about the sort of higher spending group? And these differences that we see at the median persist and even grow if you look at the top half of the spending of the burden distribution. And again, you just compare typical the 75th percentile. So think about the person in the typical person in the top half of the burden distribution. In Idaho, that person spends 11% of income, while in New York they spend around 6.5%. So these differences that appear in one part of the distribution seem to carry through the rest of the distribution as well. That indicates
and by the higher percentile of the burden distribution, you're referring to someone who's making greater use of the healthcare system.
Well, it's sort of relative to income.
Yes.
So that if you think of what someone can expect to spend out of their take-home pay or out of their total income, this suggests that someone in Idaho should expect to spend about twice as much of their income as someone in New York would spend.
So would you characterize these data as surprising? I mean, we think of New York, California, a couple other locations, Massachusetts, where I am, as being high-cost centers for health care. Are you saying that they may be high cost, but they're not necessarily high cost relative to income?
So that's right. That you pick up on a very important point, that this measure of financial burden has both a spending component and an income component. And a state could appear to be a very high burden state if it's just because it's a low income state. And if people have the same medical care needs but lower income, their burden would appear to be higher. And so that those same differences that would be apparent between individuals show up across states. So low-income states are more likely to show high burden than high-income states. But then the other factor that matters and varies from state to state, as you mentioned, is that healthcare costs more in some states than it does in others. And so two states that have similar levels of income, but different levels of medical care costs, will also show up as having different levels of financial burden.
Let's look at perhaps some of the states that we think of as having particular problems in this area, and whose governors had at least initially said that they would not buy into the Medicaid expansion. I'm thinking off the top of my head of places like Louisiana, Mississippi, where also traditional state-level Medicaid coverage is rather slim.
Right.
So that there is probably a higher burden now for lower-income folk in those states.
Right. So if you look specifically at the low-income population, which is where we wanted to get to, the differences across states just seem to grow quite a bit. That in every state, the average amount that a low-income household spends on health care is going to be higher as a percentage of income than high-income households. But the sort of range that we see between low-income folks in some states and other states is quite dramatic. And then if you then further focus in on the population who doesn't have Medicaid, the low-income population that doesn't have Medicaid, that's kind of where the policy implication is strongest. And you mentioned Louisiana and Mississippi as two examples, and they happen to be, if you look at the top five states nationwide in terms of the share of their population who is low-income and doesn't have Medicaid and has high medical care burden, those two are among those top five. Nevada is actually the state with the highest fraction of its population who is not covered by Medicaid has high burden and low income. But Nevada has decided that it's going to go ahead with the Medicaid expansion. Mm-hmm. So what we would expect is that, you know, among these states that currently have appear to have a large portion of population who would be affected by the expansion, some of these states who go ahead with the expansion, we expect them to reduce this, reduce their place on this ranking. So Nevada, we expect to fall, once it expands its Medicaid program, out of this top five, while Louisiana and Mississippi, we expect will likely stay as a high burden state for the low-income population.
Right, unless they do accede to some pressures from the hospital industry and others who would like to see some of their free care get reimbursed, which they would do if they had the Medicaid expansion in place.
And so, I mean, and it's interesting, among these top five states that we found, there were two, Nevada and Montana, who have agreed to expansion. Two have said no to expansion so far. And one in Arkansas that has said yes to an expansion, sort of, in that it would like to use a private, use the exchange system to expand coverage to this low-income population. So you could sort of think of this as an intermediate case. And it'll be interesting to see what happens to a measure like this. If the private version of the Medicaid expansion looks like Medicaid in that it has very low or zero cost-sharing requirements of its beneficiaries, I would expect that what will happen in Arkansas will look very much like what happens in states that have full public expansion of Medicaid.
So that would be private pay in the Arkansas model?
So if what happens is that beneficiaries are fully subsidized to join private plans, you could imagine that they'll see very little difference between that and a public sector Medicaid expansion. But if they're required to, if what happens is that they get some subsidy for enrolling in a private plan that doesn't fully cover their expenses, then it may well be that they don't reduce this burden.
Right. I had understood that there were not a whole lot of waivers available in order to reconfigure the way in which the Medicaid expansion would work so that federal dollars would not necessarily be available for private mm-hmm. premiums versus reimbursement of additional Medicaid expenses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I was a little surprised at how quickly they seemed to, the federal government seemed to agree to a private version of covering this population in some form. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Sure. 50 laboratories, as they say.
And yeah, this is sort of one of the key takeaways for us, I think, was that, you know, we see where the world or where the states line up now before the ACA is fully implemented, and this is kind of an ideal from a social science perspective experiment. Let's say we have 50 different approaches, and we've got the state of the world before implementation, and it'll be a good sort of natural experiment to see what happens.
Sure. And you have a good level of confidence in the data source that you're using in terms of the sort of self-reported statements that you described?
Well, you know, Kyle actually is one of the people who did a study comparing this data source to other established sources, and I think there was the Census Bureau folks, which is where Kyle was before he joined us, are fairly satisfied with the quality of this data, and it was a boon to us in the health services research world that the CPS added this question, and I think we're beginning to see the usefulness of it in some of these research projects we've undertaken.
Sure. I imagine you have a cache of some other questions that you'd love to see added to that questionnaire as well.
We have endless sets of questions that we would love to see added, but the Census Bureau is very careful with expanding that survey. I think they're worried about burdening their respondents too much, and I think rightly so. This has been a great source of information even before this, before these questions were added, especially on estimating coverage differences across states. But we're just happy that they were able to add this most recently.
Great. So how does this piece of work fit in with the other work that you've been doing about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I think that we've also, using other data sources, looked at differences in access to care across states and differences in coverage across states, and kind of also trying to get a sense of where the world is before the ACA gets into full swing. And, I think that we find similar amounts of variation in sort of the use of in access to basic health care and in the use of preventive services. I think that, that the findings there, I think, from what I remember, other members of our staff here have worked on that, but the preventive care differences have been a little less dramatic, but certainly access to basic care does appear to have a bit of variation from state to state. And that we expect, as coverage is expanded through both Medicaid and exchange and other methods, that we expect some of those differences in access to care to shrink. But that's, again, another, we'll see what happens.
Right. Well, again, Tim and Kyle, thank you very much for joining me today. It's been a very interesting conversation for me, and I hope for our listeners and readers. And again, this is David Harlow at HealthBlog. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.